You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. You're tuned to This Week in Radio News. I'm Tom Rowe in the Wave Farm Study Center in upstate New York. Nathan Fried Wessler, a staff attorney in the American Civil Liberty Union's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, on October 30th released FBI and FAA documents with new details about the surveillance flights that flew over protests in Baltimore following the police killing of Freddie Gray. Documents obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request reveal the FBI used infrared and night vision cameras, and it is holding on to surveillance video it recorded from the sky. Courts may eventually rule if warrants are needed to take infrared images inside homes. According to its flight logs, the ACLU reports the FBI flew 10 surveillance flights over Baltimore between April 29th and May 3rd, with a Baltimore Police Department official also on half the flights. FAA documents show the Cessna propeller plane registered to the FBI front company NG Research had surveillance camera equipment on board, including an infrared camera mount and an FLIR tail-on multi-sensor camera system on the exterior of the plane. That FLIR system includes a thermal imager, an optical camera, and a laser illuminator for recording at night. Wessler from the ACLU writes, quote, "In its Domestic Investigations and Operations Guide, the FBI takes the position that no Fourth Amendment protections apply to aerial surveillance conducted from navigable airspace." While that is an accurate statement of Supreme Court precedent when it comes to visual observation and use of normal cameras from a plane, it fails to grapple with the effects of advances in surveillance technology. Use of infrared and night vision camera technology changes the equation by raising the potential for invasions of privacy. If the infrared camera is capable of observing information about the inside of private homes and offices, for example, the Supreme Court has already explained that the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement applies. Justin Peters in Slate magazine reports that the Federal Aviation Administration has named a 26-member panel that will decide the rules of registering radio-controlled drones in the United States. And not one of the folks on the panel is a proponent of civil liberties or a privacy advocate. Sure, there are representatives from the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, the Aerospace Industries Association, drone makers DJI and Parrot, online retailers Google and Amazon, and big box retailers Best Buy and Walmart. Quote, "I think it's not obvious to the FAA that civil liberties groups should be involved because the FAA largely understands itself as having to balance a safety mandate against restricting innovation," unquote. Ohio State University law professor Margot Kaminsky said, quote, "The makeup of this list reflects that framing," unquote. Comcast announced it is expanding its internet data caps to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Little Rock, Arkansas, Huema, La Place, and Shreveport, Louisiana, Chattanooga, Gray, Greenville, Johnson City, and Rarity Bay, Tennessee, and Galax, Virginia. This year, Comcast now has more internet than TV customers and is certainly interested in maximizing profits. Comcast is limiting data in the markets and rolling out a $35 unlimited option to most of the areas that have those data caps. Quote, "Comcast continues to exert its dominance in the uncompetitive market for high-speed internet access, increasing the bottom line for its incredibly profitable broadband business," unquote. Matt Wood, the policy director for Free Press, said in an emailed statement. He added that the caps, quote, "stifle innovation and choice in online video and cloud-based services," unquote. Reuters reports that the Federal Communications Commission and the Justice Department are both looking into a California company broadcasting in more than a dozen major American cities backed by a subsidiary of the Chinese government. Reuters uncovered what it is calling a, quote, "covert radio network," unquote, broadcasting in Washington, Philadelphia, Boston, Houston, San Francisco, and other American cities. Quote, "Based on reports, the FCC will initiate an inquiry into the facts surrounding the foreign ownership issues raised in the stories, including whether the commission's statutory foreign ownership rules have been violated," unquote, FCC spokesman Neil Grace said. G&E Studio is owned by James Su, a naturalized U.S. citizen born in Shanghai. G&E Studio is 60% owned by a subsidiary of Chinese state-run radio broadcaster China Radio International. The FCC does not allow foreign governments or their representatives to hold radio licenses in America. Foreign individuals, governments, and corporations can only hold up to a 20% interest in a station and up to 25% in a U.S. parent corporation of a radio or television station. Content on G&E stations, Reuters reports, is produced at G&E's West Covina, California studios or by China Radio International in Beijing. Quote, the news programming on these CRI-backed stations sticks closely to the Chinese government line on a host of issues, including the current military standoff in the South China Sea between China and the United States, unquote, Reuters claims. James Hsu's spokeswoman declined to comment on November 2nd, but on September 16th told Reuters his radio network abides by U.S. law because he leases all the airtime from stations rather than owning them outright. Read the full story from Reuters. Matthew Lazar reports in Radio Survivor that British broadcast regulator Ofcom has closed 400 pirate radio stations lately, mostly in two London boroughs, and says it could save British taxpayers up to £1 million by cracking down on that city's remaining pirate radio stations. How? Quote, pirate stations typically use high-rise buildings for their broadcasts, with illegal transmitters installed on rooftops or hidden in lift shafts, unquote, Ofcom says. This is sort of correct. Pirates, like other FM broadcasters, put their antenna high up for a broader reach. Quote, this damages residential properties owned by local authorities, disrupting residents' lives and putting people at risk from falling equipment, unquote, the agency claims. Actually, hanging a pirate radio antenna would not do any more damage than putting a television antenna on a roof would, and would be just as likely to fall. Ofcom quotes a group called Homes for Haringey, saying that pirate operations had delayed key construction projects. One of their board documents blames construction delays on, among other things, quote, pirate radio aerials that have affected the progress of the completion of external works on some schemes, unquote. Ofcom makes no effort to itemize the £1 million savings figure that shutting down more pirate radio stations would achieve, and it is difficult to imagine how an antenna could delay a construction project. Ofcom also says pirate radio disrupts emergency services without giving any examples. In this latest press offensive, Ofcom throws everything at the pirate radio menace except that old myth that regulators constantly sing about pirate radio bringing down airplanes. Ofcom actually put out this Pirate Radio Summit YouTube video. Let's listen along.
Homes for Haringey has been working with Ofcom for the past 18 months to tackle pirate radio. Beginning of 2014, we had 19 stations transmitting from our roofs.
We are on the Hillcrest Estate here in Highgate, and blocks behind me are repeatedly being targeted by pirate radio. And if you look at the very top, there is two pirate radio aerials in place. The pirates free climb that particular mast. We can't do so. We have to employ steeplejacks, and the cost is exceptionally high and very, very dangerous for them.
And since January 2015, there are no stations remaining and no transmissions have been sustained since then. We benefit from this partnership working by significantly reducing the cost to tackle pirate radio through this very proactive and more preventative approach.
So what we're seeing now in London is a displacement effect where the good work that the councils and the housing associations are conducting on the high-rise tower blocks are forcing the pirate stations, the illegal broadcasters, onto the lower-rise blocks, whereas normally they would install on tower blocks 20, 22, 23 stories high, and every block in this row has a pirate installation on its roof, and they're all only five stories high. But this is an example of the effects that the good work on the high-rise tower blocks is having.
Hackney Homes, in partnership with Ofcom, working with the police to remove these masts that are causing annoyance and nuisance to our residents.
The pirate that's on this block is gaining their electricity supply from this electric box. It goes round into the eaves of the roof, and then it goes out onto this slanted roof that we've got here, and the aerial is attached to the chimney stack, and the transmitter is located down the chimney stack. Obviously, we're unable to get that because of its location, but what we can do is disconnect the power and remove the aerial, which is what the guys are up there doing now.
While such interference may not happen frequently, Ofcom and the National Air Traffic Service mobilise resources quickly and efficiently to effectively deal with the problems caused by pirate radio stations to the safety of planes within UK airspace. Pilots who experience such interference have real problems. Eric Moody, a former British Airways pilot who regularly flew Boeing 747 jumbo jets, said this when interviewed in 2007. When you're in cloud for the majority of your approach and you don't see an aeroplane and you're at minute intervals coming into Heathrow, if you miss an instruction and you go flying off on a track you shouldn't be on, it's very, very dangerous.
NATS is the air traffic service provider for all air traffic flying over UK airspace. And here in Terminal Control, we are also responsible for all the approaches into the five major London airports. In 2014, NATS made 55 complaints to Ofcom regarding the interference caused by pirate radio stations. This obviously has a big effect on our operation and can actually affect the safety that we can provide to these aircraft. These risks are minimised by both the professionalism of both the NATS and the Ofcom staff.
You can't go on pirate radio and do what you like. We know that. We know that we're illegal, right? And we are working, well, we should be working to change that. Pirate radio is created an element of, how can I say, an element of society, business or whatever, that has seen it for what it is and has come up with that answer that we've seen time and time again. That's a bit of money there. Let's grab that. I'm all right, Jack. Forget it after that. It needs to be policed and it needs to go back to what it was originally set up for, to help the community.
Ofcom offers legal and accessible opportunities to get on the airwaves. And since 2005, we've been offering community radio licenses and over 200 stations are now operating under that scheme across the UK. Some of those stations are run by people who used to broadcast illegally, and all of them offer opportunities for people who aspire to get involved in broadcasting, the opportunity for a safe and legitimate environment for them to get involved.
So that was Ofcom, the British broadcast regulator, and their propaganda about pirate radio in London. There's propaganda in the United States, too. On November 5th, Republican Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake both released a report showing that United States taxpayers spent $7 million on propaganda patriotic displays at professional and college sporting events in the last 4 years. Giant payouts were made to professional sports teams like the Atlanta Falcons, the Los Angeles Galaxy, the New England Patriots, the Milwaukee Brewers, and others. Basically, giving tax handouts to owners of rich sports teams. Quote, "What is upsetting is when you see activities like this that people assume when they go to games are paid for out of the goodness of the heart by the owners and the teams, and then find out that taxpayers are paying for it. It kind of cheapens it, and it's simply not right," unquote, Flake said at a news conference with McCain on November 5th. Next up, we'll tune in The Hidden Language of Trees, from Massachusetts radio artist Gregory Whitehead, from 1998, The Hidden Language of Trees, on This Week in Radio News.
Right. When I first saw the title of your report, The Radical Language of Trees, I thought it must be about landscape architecture, but you mean language quite literally. And why is that so surprising? Well, it's only surprising in the context of a capacity for arrogance. It's, I'm sorry, I didn't. I mean,
it's not you. I don't. I'm not responding personally. It's just I'm just so sickened by the years of ridicule and the level of ignorance and arrogance throughout this story has just been appalling.
Oh, maybe we just take a step backward and you can describe what you mean by radical language.
It's radical because this is a phenomenon that happens underground. Language because the phenomena is a distinct form of expression that maintains a consistent meaning through time. In short, it is a radical language in the most direct sense. It is language conducted by and through the roots.
So you mean to suggest that tree roots are producing sound?
No, I have never maintained that. That is the misinterpretation that's bandied about by my adversaries. I am not proposing that the roots emit sound, but rather they emit vibrations, and I have developed a special device, a little black box that that effectively translates those vibrations into audible sound.
A little black box.
In concept, it is not unlike an early wax cylinder phonograph. It has diaphragm and a stylus. It's sensitive to the pressure of the vibrations. The signal is filtered and compressed and transmitted to the surface through a standard length of aluminum conduit, which I've wired with a contact microphone in order to make the documentary recordings.
Well, I understand you're actually able to provoke response from the trees by playing some kind of clarinet.
Yes, it's an alto clarinet. I don't pretend to play it particularly well, but it does achieve the desired result. Of course, from the standpoint of the trees, it's not the sound of the music that's meaningful, but the vibrations.
And the recordings you sent me in advance, the vibrations sound not dissimilar to whales or elephant mating.
Yes, well, it has been one of my underlying assumptions from the outset of this long research project that the world's great trees have been in active and engaged communication with large mammals for millennia. This is something that might help to explain certain evolutionary advantages enjoyed by those species. Advantages, I should say, that are not satisfactorily explained by some of the competing evolutionary theories.
So large mammals, but what about humans?
Humans as well, though perhaps we've been slower to respond. I've long been impressed in conversation with experienced woodsmen or foresters. They were often talk about being able to sense impending danger around the next bend in the great forest in the bones. And of course, with our superior self-image as a species, we immediately assume that this is some genetically inscribed survival instinct. But it's my contention that what's actually going on here is that the individual is receiving the radical language, that the vibrations are being transmitted through the bones, that the bones are conducting the vibrations as a form of urgent signal of danger or whatever, directly up into the brain.
So that funny feeling in the tummy, those are radical vibrations.
That's right.
Why such benevolent behavior from trees to their most voracious predator?
But the fact is, it's our destructive behavior towards trees that is actually fairly recent, displacing a far more sympathetic relationship that has existed throughout most of time and until quite recently. And this mutuality persists in the customs of many rural communities and indigenous tribes around the world.
So you're not suggesting that trees are inhabited by strange talking spirits or anything like that?
No, at least not in the sense that spirits are producing the actual vibrations, but even that contention would, in my view, be far less ridiculous than the prevailing notion that trees are immutably dumb. There are just so many cultures and individuals around the world who scrupulously attend to the spirits of great trees, and that just makes immaculately perfect sense to me, as does our own practice of returning to trees during times of spiritual need. There's this very well-known passage. I brought some things to read in my briefcase. A wonderful passage in the life of Buddha. Therefore, with resolution as his only support and companion, he set his mind on enlightenment and proceeded to the root of a peepal tree where the ground was carpeted with green grass. I never know whether it's pipe hole or peephole. Well, in any event, Budo was tuned into the radical language.
Oh, unquestionably. Now, in other instances, the dialogue with trees might be based more directly in survival needs, the tree offering shelter and sustenance, and human communities offering some measure of protection to the trees in return. And this is regularly recorded in literature. My favorite poem, from Wordsworth at least, is dates from 1803, and it's about the yew in Lorton. There is a yew, the pride of Lorton's Vale, which to this day stands single in the midst of its own darkness as it stood of yore. A vast circumference and gloom profound, this solitary tree, a living thing, produced too slowly ever to decay, of form and aspect too magnificent to be destroyed.
Oh, that's really lovely.
Yes, I've long wanted to travel to Lorton to see what's become of this tree. On the other hand, there's the so-called Boscobel oak that offered sanctuary to Charles II in his escape from the Cromwellians. And this tree was quite literally dismembered, torn limb from limb by those wanting a special keepsake. And the tree was dead by the end of the 19th century.
You refer to the many literary traditions that really animate tree roots.
Yes, there's a mountain of that material. It really is it's its own separate literary genre. I guess my favorite is this unabashedly romantic passage from Nathaniel Lee's Oedipus. Nor tree grows here, but what is fed with magic juice, all full of human souls that cleave their barks to dance at midnight by the moon's pale beams.
Very nice. I notice that many of your citations are from English sources. Were you educated in England, or?
No, I spent a little bit of time at Oxford when I was at university here in the States, but the fact is I'm just terribly fond of England. The people appreciate their trees quite profoundly for the most part, and it's one of the few places where I have felt the presence of truly kindred spirits. When I give presentations, the responses well, it's always very polite, but sometimes it's even quite enthusiastic.
All right. Towards the end of your report, you seem to hint at the existence of something resembling a collective arboreal intelligence.
Well, I began thinking of it as more as a metaphor. It's hard to look at photographs or visual extrapolated representations of one sort or another of the vast intertwining root systems beneath the ground of the great forest without conjuring up a comparable image of the tangled neurons of the human brain. But as I've spent more and more time in the last vestiges of the primeval forest around the world, I've begun to at least entertain the idea that there may in fact be something resembling a sort of a green brain that would account for the sense of not being alone amongst the redwoods and the larches. Once you tune into it, it's really quite a moving experience, and it needs to be reckoned with and accounted for.
You even speculate that this green brain may be fired by cosmic radiation.
Yes, well, I am certainly not an astrophysicist, but it has occurred to me that trees may in some way be acting as receptors or filters or mediators, really, for the ubiquitous microwave radiation produced by the Big Bang approximately 15 billion years ago, and that this intermediary role may account for the innumerable creation myths around the world that associate the voice of God, the location of the voice of God, with the presence or predominance of great trees.
So massive deforestation not just eliminates a natural resource, but actually terminates intelligence.
I doubt I could put it better myself. Perhaps you want to join me on some of these lecture tours.
No thanks, but I am really struck by your consistent willingness to take literary motifs as grounded in science.
Yes, well, ever since the story of the German archaeologist Heinrich Schliemann, who was digging for years to uncover the ruins of Troy and was ridiculed for many years for having fallen prey to the fevered imagination of some primitive author named Homer. And then, of course, he discovered it, and surely since then we should keep at least one ear open to the possibility that that ancient imaginations as captured in some of these sublime texts may indeed point the way to some critical or central scientific discovery.
That was radio artist Gregory Whitehead and The Hidden Language of Trees from 1998 on This Week in Radio News. I'm Tom Rowe reporting for Wavefarm Radio and WGXC. The preceding show was recorded at Wavefarm's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.